This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. The year was 2005. Steve Majewski was sitting in a science conference in Colorado listening to other astronomers describe difficulties mapping the middle of the Milky Way. Majewski, who had long studied the outer edges of the galaxy, knew there were huge challenges to peering into the center, but was disappointed to hear these scientists had only been able to track a few dozen stars. Steve thought to himself, we ought to be able to do 1,000 times better than that. It turned out not to be an idle thought. When he returned home to Charlottesville, Steve put together a consortium, first of fellow scientists at the University of Virginia, and then with other colleagues around the world. Within 6 years, they created technology that could indeed track thousands of stars never before seen. The potential for improving understanding of our universe is, well, astronomical. So this whole new way of viewing our galaxy will be our focus right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. And to you who are listening, I've got one all-important word to mention about the upcoming discussion. Help. Okay, two words. Please help. The world of astrophysics is on the table, and when it comes to anything about physics, chances are so very good that you know far more about the right questions to ask than I. By phone, we are at 888-WMRA-TALK. On Facebook, we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And even with my limited understanding, I think it is still safe to say that the three scientists with me here in the Insight studio have created a revolution in the world of astronomy. Because of them, a new kind of device is now being used to examine thousands of stars in the center of our galaxy that were never before seen. It's called the Apogee Project. Gail Sosowski is still a few weeks away from completing her doctorate at the University of Virginia, but her colleagues say she has been instrumental in the success of this new project. Word also is that it was former Navy Commander John Wilson's work in engineering, even before he became a senior scientist at UVA, that was critical to his ability to construct this new device. And the idea that started all this came from a Virginia astronomer who was able to put together an international support team, leader of the Apogee Project, Dr. Steve Majewski. Thank you all so much for making time for us.
Good afternoon, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Well, Steve, your work is bringing science a new understanding about the Milky Way. So, first question, what is the Milky Way?
Oh, it's a good question. And we're very lucky in Virginia to be one of the states on the East Coast that has places that are dark enough where people can actually go out and see the Milky Way. Unfortunately, many people in the U.S. now live near cities, don't get a chance to see the Milky Way. But if you go out to a very dark site and look up in the sky, you'll see a milky white band going across the sky of diffuse white light. And that is the Milky Way. And the Milky Way is a collection of stars, of which our sun is one. There are about 100 billion stars in this collection. They swirl around a center, which is about 25,000 light years away in the constellation of Sagittarius. And we're inside of this distribution of stars. The stars are distributed something like a flattened pinwheel or pancake. And the reason we see the Milky Band in the sky is because we're inside the pancake. And an analogy we can use is if you're a raisin in a raisin pancake, you look out along the pancake, you're going to see more pancake in one direction and less pancake in the other direction, perpendicular to the pancake. And that's what we're looking at when we see the Milky Way. We're seeing a collection of 100 billion stars in the sky, of which our sun and our Earth goes around the sun. We have this one sun, and there are many, many more in the Milky Way.
Some people like me may even have trouble differentiating between what a solar system is and what a galaxy is. Milky Way is a galaxy, and did you say it contains about 100 billion stars?
Yes, yes, right. That's one with 11 zeros. Yes.
That's a number beyond my ability to fathom, I think.
Well, and then people who work in the economy probably now can think.
And then when you take into, you consider that there could be 100 billion galaxies out there, each of which have 100 billion stars. It's pretty hard to fathom, as you said.
So, John Wilson, what makes something a galaxy? How do you separate from one galaxy to the next?
Well, it's a close assembly of of these 100 billion stars, and then there is a vast amount of space that's essentially a vacuum, a great vacuum. Of course, between these galaxies, we think there is quite a bit of gas, in fact, and we're learning more and more about that as we study the universe in different wavelengths. But it's essentially a concentration of mass and then a great distance to another concentration. And folks liken this to a cosmic web. And these this assembly of mass is at the places where these
filaments
come
together. So you get these concentrations of stars forming galaxies. But as John said, in between there's these huge, vast voids, you know, even larger than the galaxies themselves.
So, Gail Zasowski, I heard John say that there may be 100 billion galaxies. Do we have any concrete idea of how many there are or how many have been discovered so far?
Well, the ones we count certainly number, you know, hundreds of thousands to millions of them. Part of the problem is that as you look, you know, farther and farther away, you're seeing things and they're fainter and fainter and fainter. And so in some sense, we're still limited by the technology that we have as to how faint we can measure things, which also restricts us to how far in distance we can see, how much of the universe we can actually measure.
And we're also limited by the fact that it takes time for the light from these distant objects to get to us. And so we're limited by the age of the universe. We can only see out to a horizon to which the light could still get from the beginning of time can get to us. So we don't know how big the universe is because we can only see a certain horizon for which the light could get to us in the 13 billion years that the universe has been around.
And just to keep it clear for people who need real simple explanations like myself, the universe is what contains all of the galaxies.
Right, right.
That you know,
contains everything.
If I may say, there's nothing in our galaxy like this. I'm talking about a smaller unit of existence than if I say there's nothing in our universe like this. Because the universe may be what John was talking about that could contain 100
right.
billion galaxies.
Well, I'm not quite sure I know what you're getting at, but it is interesting that about 100 years ago, the Milky Way was thought to be the universe. So people didn't have a concept that there were other galaxies like the Milky Way. The Milky Way, people could see there were lots of stars. They could see they were in the flattened pancake. They didn't know that there were other galaxies out there until it was realized that these little fuzzy blobs were galaxies like our own. And so Apogee is actually a project that is looking at the Milky Way. It's focused on the Milky Way, but we think the Milky Way is just one representative galaxy of all the galaxies in the universe. What makes the Milky Way special is that we're in it. And so we have a much better view of what's going on, and we can get a lot of detailed information about the stars and gas and things that are in our Milky Way. So it serves as a local laboratory for understanding galaxies in general.
So Steve Majewski, lead scientist for the Apache Point Observatory Galactic Evolution Experiment, Apogee.
Apogee.
What is Apogee and why is it important?
Well, Apogee is the first attempt to make a comprehensive analysis of the stars in all parts of the galaxy and with large numbers of stars so we can actually get a huge statistical amount of information and a census of what is going on in different parts of the galaxy. And what makes our experiment unique is that we are trying to probe from the very heart of the galaxy, in the very center, all the way to the outer parts. In the past, people have done surveys, little surveys, or even large surveys, but they've concentrated in certain places that were that their instrument was designed to be good at. We had to build an instrument that could survey all of the parts of the Milky Way. And one of the problems that we have, and people who actually can see the Milky Way from a dark site, will notice if they look at the white milky patch in the sky that is the Milky Way, they'll notice that there are black patches in amongst the white. It's a very mottled appearance. And that mottling is dust. So the problem is that we have dust in the galaxy. And that can block the light from stars behind the dust from coming to our eyes. And so at optical wavelengths, the wavelengths where our eyes work, we don't get a clear view of the Milky Way, even though we're right inside of it. And
if I understand correctly, Steve, what you're trying to look at in basically the center of the Milky Way and then out from there is the area where there is the most dust and
yes.
also thought to be the most number of stars.
Right. So most of the stars are also coupled in and mixed in with where most of the dust is. And the dust blocks optical light and makes it very hard to see. What?
But you discovered a way to see through the dust.
Well, I didn't discover it. It's been well known that the dust does not block infrared light as well as it blocks optical light. So we get a much clearer view of what the Milky Way looks like if we work at longer wavelengths, that is the light that is beyond the wavelengths of that our eye can see. And so infrared light, which many people associate with heat, heat light is the light that we can actually see much, much deeper into the heart of the galaxy, where all a lot of interesting things are going on that haven't been surveyed very well to date.
The key insight was Steve and also Mike Skrutsky, another professor at the University of Virginia, realizing that, you know, we have this infrared technology that's driven by a lot of recent developments in the last few decades. And their insight was, hey, here's a great science problem that we can bring this new technology to bear, and we can do that in this decade. And then the Apogee project took off from there.
So, John Wilson, when your colleague Steve Majeski was talking about using infrared light to see is a word in the English language that we often use that has nothing to do with our visual sight. It mostly has to do with the idea of retrieving data, which is exactly what your instrument that uses infrared light is doing. Tell us about that process, about that element of seeing.
Absolutely. It's a good question, you know, because we're, you know, everything that we think about when we see is based on the wavelengths that we see with our eyes, the colors, I should say, that we see with our eyes. And we see, we think of those colors as what we see in the rainbow, which is, you know, sunlight getting spread out in water droplets in the sky. Our eyes are tuned essentially to the primary wavelengths, the primary colors that the sun is putting out. But there's a vast spectrum of colors, and I put the colors in air quotes here, that range from X-rays all the way to radio waves that we're using right now for this radio program. Just a little bit beyond what we see with our eyes can't detect this light, but it's infrared light. And astronomers are more and more using all of these different colors, again, quote unquote, to learn about astrophysical phenomena. In this case, it turns out that telescopes made to collect light that we see with our eyes are excellent for collecting the light at the colors that we're using, these near-infrared wavelengths. And we use typical optical techniques to collect that light. We can't use the same detectors that we use, say, in cameras that use CCD technology, but we use detectors that are very similar to collect that infrared light and to put it into computers. No one's sitting there, you know, looking at the galaxy, the information that we're collecting with our eyes. It's all going into computers. But and we also use camera systems and other optics that work just like optical instruments. It's just that we have slightly different materials that we need to use when we go to the near-infrared wavelengths.
University of Virginia astronomer Steve Majeski is lead scientist on the International Astronomy Investigation Effort we're discussing this hour. UVA astronomer John Wilson is senior scientist on that effort. And UVA doctoral student Gail Zasowski is a principal investigator. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you have questions for any of our guests or theories or thoughts you want to offer about what goes on in the Milky Way, you're welcome to join in at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Steve Majeski, why is this research important?
Well, it's important because we have an interesting scenario in front of us. The Milky Way is the galaxy that we can probe the best. Unfortunately, we're inside of it. So we don't have an external perspective of what the Milky Way looks like. So we want to actually understand the entire shape and structure of our galaxy and then use that information coupled with the detailed information on individual stars to understand what other galaxies are like and how they formed and look the way they do today.
Terribly unfair of me to ask that question right when we were getting close to the break, because I understand there is also information that you are gathering that could lead us to clues about the origins of the universe. So I want to ask you about that when we continue.
The sun is a miasma of incandescent plasma. The sun's not simply made out of gas. No, no, no. The sun is a quagmire. It's not made of fire. Forget what you've been told in the past.
Plasma.
Electrons are free.
Plasma.
A false state of matter, not gas. Not liquid, not solid.
The group They Might Be Giants with their correction song, Why Does the Sun Really Shine?, after having done a previous song just called The Sun, where they got some of the science wrong. And Steve Majewski from the University of Virginia and lead scientist on this Apogee project that we're discussing. I take it that the part of what you're doing is correcting previously wrong assumptions about science, about astronomy, that in the detail that you're now getting about our galaxy, you must be able to say things that could not previously be said for certain.
Yeah, so I don't know that we're correcting things, but we're finding things that other people could not have seen, just simply because we are doing things in such a tour de force manner. We're collecting large numbers of spectra of stars, information, rainbows. We're taking starlight from many stars and breaking it up into information that was not available to other astronomers.
Do I understand that this infrared technology that basically was invented by John Wilson, so I'm going to ask him about that in a moment, this new revolutionary device that you created and that you're now using hooked to a telescope in New Mexico, that among the things it can tell you is the chemical nature of different stars?
Right. So one of the things that we're interested in understanding is how a universe that was created in a Big Bang that created mostly hydrogen helium, how did we go to such a simple chemical pattern of hydrogen helium to systems like the solar system that has rocky planets made of iron and silicon, that have life on them made of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, other things? How do we go from a very simple prescription of hydrogen helium into these heavier elements that create everything around us? And the reason that we have these heavier elements is that they've all been created in the centers of stars through nuclear fusion. And so stars, just like the song, we are stardust. That's because the stars are what process hydrogen helium into heavier elements. And that it's through explosions of stars and the loss of mass from stars where heavier elements can be populated into new stars. And through generations of stars created in the Milky Way, we get heavier and heavier elements that eventually get to the to abundances where we can have rocky planets and life. And so by studying the Milky Way very intensely, we can understand the chemistry of the stars. We look for stars that have different ages, and we can see how the process went from very simple abundance patterns of hydrogen and helium to stars that are, like our sun, that are filled with all kinds of chemical elements that are also found in the planets around it.
Is it reasonable to say that one of the things that you're doing in these investigations is looking back through time?
Yes. So we're doing something that is often called galactic archaeology. The Milky Way is a large place, but on the scale of the universe, it's relatively close. And we're seeing light that's relatively young light. We're looking at stars that are relatively close to us. So we're seeing things pretty much as they are today. But when we look at the stars and their chemical fingerprints, which are imprinted in the rainbow of light that they give off, we can actually see what chemical elements are in their atmospheres. And by picking stars selectively throughout the galaxy, we can look to see where the chemical elements are created and how they were created, and come up with theories that will explain why the Milky Way has certain stars in certain places that have different chemical patterns.
Steve has I did want to make one point, and that is
this is John Wilson.
Sorry. I did want to make one point is that, quite a bit is already known about galactic structures and different kinds of galaxies out there in our universe by observations of nearby galaxies. And so we already have a sort of a big picture of what galaxies look like, and we sort of think we know what our galaxy looks like. But what Apogee's doing is it's, and other surveys like it, is for the first time we're going to be able to look in depth at the whole Milky Way structure in a uniform way. So it might be better to think of Apogee as learning more about one galaxy at the smaller scale, and then we're going to compare that to our knowledge of these other galaxies out there that we can only understand on a big scale because they're so far away. And Steve, you have a nice analogy about a marching band.
Oh right, yeah. So the thing about the Milky Way is that even though we're inside of it, we actually know in some ways a lot less about it than other galaxies that we can see with an external perspective. And the analogy is that if you see a marching band on a football field, they're making patterns and they might be swirling around just like the Milky Way is swirling around and rotating around a center. But the individual band members can't really see the pattern that they're making. They're responding to some pattern that they've decided to make. But only the people who have an external perspective, the people in the stands looking down on that pattern, can actually see the what word they're spelling or whatever. And Apogee is like that. We're trying to probe the band members around us. We can see the stars near us. And if the band is kicking up a lot of dust, it's even harder. You can't see the band members far away if they're kicking up a lot of dust. Apogee, we're working in the infrared. We can probe all of the band members all the way across the football field and use that information to put together a map of the Milky Way.
Former commander in the U.S. Navy, now senior scientist in the University of Virginia's Astronomy Department, John Wilson is one of our guests. Doctoral student in that department, Gail Sisowski, is another. And sitting beside her, also from UVA, the lead scientist for the Apache Point Observatory Galactic Evolution Experiment, easier to remember as Apogee, Steve Majewski. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. Our call-in phone number is 888-WMRA-TALK, or if you want to post a comment or question online, you can do so on our Facebook page, which is listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Okay, John Wilson, we've been talking about Apogee, which is basically the name for the entire research project. But it is dependent completely on this device that you created. Is it accurate to call that device a spectrograph?
It sure is. And
as I said at the outset, Steve got the idea for this while he was sitting in a conference somewhere in Colorado with a bunch of other astronomers, being really disheartened by how little was being discovered about the middle of the Milky Way, because there was no way to do it. And he thought to himself, there ought to be some way to do it. And somewhere along the line, between that meeting in 2005 and when you finalized this project a year ago this month, I think, is when this went online, you were able to create a device for which, when Steve first got this idea, the technology did not exist to make it possible. So tell us how you did this and what you did.
Well, there were a lot of yous in your sentences, so I would hasten to say, how did you all do it? Because it literally took a village. And one of the things I love about astronomy instrumentation is the fact that different groups around the country and even the different across the world really are very open to sharing information and publishing their prior work. So Apogee really does rely on quite a bit of prior work, and it's not a revolutionary new design of the way to put together an optical device to spread the light into a rainbow. Where Apogee got hard, it was the speed with which we had to put it together, and it was the size of the optics needed to record 300 of these rainbows of light simultaneously and throw it all into a vacuum vessel so that we could cool everything down to less than negative 300 degrees Fahrenheit to keep the detectors cold.
The non-scientists among us, try, if you would, to describe what this device was that you were the lead scientist on creating, if that's a fair way to
put it.
Okay.
Sure.
What this device is, how it works, and what you had to create that only was possible because of recent technological advances.
Yeah. So the as we mentioned before, the telescope, the Sloan Telescope, existed already on Apache Point Observatory,
this
mountain in New Mexico, above the White Sands of Alamogordo, and they already have a good bit of they already had an infrastructure for plugging fibers into the back of these plug plates. So what that means is accurately placing up to 300 fibers at the focal plane where the light comes to a focus in the telescope. It was our job to take that light through optical fibers to an instrument that was sited in a building next door. And so that the light has to get into the fibers accurately. It travels through the fibers as in a light pipe. It goes into this instrument that I was describing that's in this vacuum chamber. We stack up all those 300 fibers essentially in a line, and then the light comes out of those fibers, and then it goes through a large optic. And this optic it's what's called a holographic grating, but it's a device that spreads the light out.
Is it made out of a huge crystal?
Well, it's really interesting. It's actually a holographically recorded pattern in gelatin, very, very thin layer of gelatin on a piece of glass, and then you cap it on another piece of glass. Now, these pieces of glass are an inch thick, but this was
a I'm getting ahead of myself. There is a giant crystal involved in this someplace.
Yeah, you're getting a little ahead of yourself.
But yeah. What you just mentioned that's based on these layers of gelatin all on top, that was a technological innovation itself.
It sure was. These had been made before, and in fact, they're very interesting. This kind of technology is used in what are called heads-up displays in fighter aircraft and maybe even in passenger airliners now, where the pilot can look through the windscreen of his of the cockpit.
But as I understand it, never as big or as complex as the one that you needed to
right.
do this research about the middle of our galaxy.
Right. And we teamed with, and that's an important part, is so not only did we have a wonderful group to help develop this, we had relationships, very close relationships with both other universities, but also importantly vendors. And so one of these vendors was in Michigan, Kaiser Optics, and we worked hard with them to develop this optic that had never been built to this size. So we had to have these three holographic recordings all onto the same piece of gelatin, but done side by side.
So where does the giant crystal come in?
So then right after the light is spread out into a rainbow, we have to bring all those rainbows to a focus onto three different infrared detectors. And that's where we use a huge 250-pound camera. It's a bit like the camera you'd put on to the end of like a Canon camera. But we use, instead of glass optics, we use most of the optics are actually made out of raw silicon. And so that took...
they're 40 centimeters in size, so they're...
Can you translate that?
25 inches?
Yeah.
When you're holding up your hands like that, I was getting a sense, but I wasn't sure anybody else was.
And they look so very different than your normal camera lenses.
Yeah. In fact, you're right, Gail. We brought a silicon wafer in here just to demonstrate, but at visual...
Go ahead. Hold it real close to the microphone.
Sorry.
No, that's okay.
So everybody can see on the radio. But, you know, silicon, you can't see through with your eyes. So it's, again, a little bit of an oddity, but we're using materials that you can't see through with your eyes, but we know that they transmit at the wavelengths that we're interested in.
And you talked early on about the 300 fibers that go through and have to travel some distance to connect to this instrumentation. You brought some of those fibers here. Again, we're going to post some pictures of some of this equipment on our website after the show. But the fibers you're talking about look to me like about the size, the width of a human hair, maybe less.
That's exactly right. And so, in fact, it's Gail's job. She's leading the effort for the team to precisely drill, to figure out where we want to precisely drill these plates.
These are the plates that capture the information?
These are the plates that go on the back of the telescope.
And they have holes in them for where we plug the fibers. And so the fibers are 190 microns in size.
About the human hair.
The human hair. And we have to get starlight accurately in the ends of those little fibers.
One of the things I think I'm picking up from what you're saying is that the precision required to do this so that you're getting absolutely accurate information, the precision required is phenomenal. It's a degree of precision that a few years ago there simply wasn't the technology to be able to accomplish?
The ability to get the light into this many fibers at once really was proven by the Sloan Sky Survey folks, which whom we're now a part of. But it was one of the very important pieces of technology that we've developed for this project was the ability to connect and disconnect 300 fibers at once. So some of your audience might be familiar with fiber optic connections, but usually everybody's familiar with just making one connection to another fiber, just a single fiber. But we have to connect every hour or so, we connect and disconnect 300 fibers simultaneously. So that took a lot of technology. And again, teaming with the vendors in the telecom industry to be able to pull that off. Because these fibers, when you connect them, they have to be very, very precisely connected so you get the light through them.
So, Gail Sosowski, you're in charge of the teams that do these connections.
Not so much on doing the connections of the fibers, but on choosing the stars to go onto these plug plates, which stars the survey is going to look at out of the 100 billion or so in the galaxy.
Can you tell me in terms that I might be able to understand what the end result of everything that John just told us about this incredible device, when all the information travels through all these different elements of the device and gets to a point where it can be read and understood, what do you have?
We have, Steve mentioned the word earlier, fingerprints. And so what we have are these infrared rainbows or these infrared fingerprints of stars that tell us things about how fast they're moving through the galaxy, what kind of chemistry they have in their atmospheres, if they have things like gas streaming outwards from their surface, if they're changing in size, if they're changing in speed towards us or away from us. We have all kinds of information on their motions and on their chemistry. And this is what lets us put together the picture of the galaxy and actually try to figure out, where the stars are, how they're moving, how they're making elements, and, how they have elements that came from other stars from earlier generations.
So it may be hard for people to visualize what's going on here. These metal plates at the back end of the telescope are about a yard across, and in them are holes that have been drilled. And then we're taking starlight and putting
300 holes, all different sizes, but very
well. They're all
precise
pretty much the same size, but they're precisely matched to a position of a star in the sky.
Okay.
That's one end of the fiber. At the other end of the fiber is coming out the light from that star in another building. It's processed through John's instrument, and then it goes into our computer where we have information, as Gail said, of all this information on star by star, 300 at a time. This is where Apogee is making its huge impact, because before, when people did this kind of work, there were spectrographs that could do infrared spectroscopy of stars, but usually they did things one at a time, one star at a time. You'd spend an hour on that star, you'd move to another star, you'd get 10 stars a night if you're very lucky. We're doing thousands of stars a night. We're doing 300 an hour. And that is where Apogee is going to make its biggest impact, building a huge database of information that astronomers and people in the public all over the world will have access to. It's a huge database, and everyone will have access to it.
University of Virginia astronomer Steve Majewski is lead scientist on the International Astronomy Investigation Effort we're discussing this hour. UVA astronomer John Wilson is senior scientist on that effort, and UVA doctoral student Gail Sosowski is a principal investigator. One of the things that I really want to know more about is something that Gail was touching on just a few moments ago about what the end result of this technological revolution in astronomy is, what kinds of information they're getting, what we may now know about our galaxy that we didn't just a couple of years ago. So those are the kind of questions I'm going to ask when we get back. You're invited to join in too in just a bit more than 1 minute. Talking about the Apogee science project here on Virginia Insight. Gail Sosowski once thought she was going to become an archaeologist, a bit ironic, really, since her colleague at the University of Virginia, fellow astronomer John Wilson, says some of the work they are doing together these days could be called galactic archaeology. And that would probably mean that UVA astronomer Steve Majewski is the galactic archaeologist in chief. It was his idea and follow-through that led to the revolution in galaxy research that we're discussing this hour, the Apogee Project. Gail, you're like barely 10 years out of high school. I think you came to UVA just a few years ago to work on your master's. You're now a few weeks away from completing your doctorate.
Mm-hmm.
You've been working on this Apogee Project for how long now?
Coming up on 2 years, 2.5 years, I think.
What has it felt like as a student to be so enmeshed in this kind of just incredible research?
It's like jumping into a very, very big pool. I mean, we're, doctor students, graduate students are sort of scientists in training, if you will. And so, quote-unquote, growing up as a scientist in this kind of enormous collaboration has just been absolutely amazing. I've gotten to meet people. I think, Steve and John have both said earlier, this is, not just a Virginia collaboration, but national and international as well. So there's scientists and hardware people from all over the world that have been involved. And so I've gotten to communicate with them and to learn from them and see how science is done on a very large scale, which is how astronomy is definitely moving, to these big groups of people being able to accomplish amazing things by pooling resources. And so learning how that's going, this early in my career has really been helpful.
But Gail really has a leg up, because I think she's being a bit modest. She's one of the most capable graduate students I've ever seen. And so for her to have this level of responsibility where she is in her career is just amazing.
Okay, so as the youngster in the group, let me direct this question to you first. Do you have hopes or ideas about, again, this project has only been online now for about a year, so I realize it's too early to tell a lot of things that are still to come.
Mm-hmm.
But do you have hopes of what might be discovered as a result of this kind of research?
Yeah, well, my particular interest and what part of my thesis is focusing on is looking at particular structures in the center of our galaxy. Like we said earlier, this is where most of the stars are, but also where most of the dust is. So this is where it's very hard to actually measure where the stars lie and how they're moving. And so a lot of my thesis is trying to look at things in the center of the galaxy using other types of data that are not going to be quite as good as Apogee. So once Apogee has enough data on this part of the galaxy, I definitely hope to use that to figure out how the center of our galaxy is shaped and how stars are put together in the middle of the galaxy.
Every time you do a large project like this, you the things you think you're going to spend most of your time working on turn out, you find new things that you had no idea were going to be out there. And Apogee, as you said, has been online for almost a year. And in that time, we've already collected 5 times as many spectra than have ever been collected on all the world's telescopes of this kind, of this detail and in infrared wavelengths. And I think Gail is very excited about the fact that just looking at the early data that we were using to test the instrument, we've already discovered things that were not predicted to be there. Some motions of stars in the center of our galaxy that we're now getting all the theory people to try to help us figure out what are we looking at here, because this is not what was expected. We had models for what we should expect to see, and we're already seeing things that make those models obsolete.
And this is actually typical of in science. When you bring to bear a new experimental technique that gives you orders of magnitude more information or access to wavelengths that you haven't had before, you typically do discover things that you weren't anticipating, the serendipitous stuff that we're finding. It's really exciting.
Can you tell me anything, Steve Majewski, that you have discovered that you can explain in sort of non-scientific terms that may lead to a different understanding of the universe than what was had before you started this research?
Well, one of the things that we've come to understand as astronomers and astrophysicists over the last couple of decades is that systems like the Milky Way actually grow what we say hierarchically. That is to say, they start off as little things, and little things come together and make bigger and bigger galaxies. The Milky Way is actually a relatively large galaxy in the local neighborhood of galaxies. And in fact, it has a number of smaller galaxies circling around it. But many of these galaxies succumb to a cannibalistic type phenomenon where the Milky Way actually shreds those smaller galaxies, and those stars in those other galaxies become part of the Milky Way. And one of the things that Apogee is going to do is trace back star by star which stars are siblings of one another that were born in another galaxy that we've digested. And as now these galaxies are shredded up, they're moving around inside the Milky Way, they're all mixed up. But by looking at the chemical patterns of the stars, we can do, it's like DNA, we can say this star and that star are siblings. They were born together in a parent galaxy that we ate. And this is the kind of information that is at a level we never had before. And it's the hope is that we can fingerprint all the systems that the Milky Way ate in its long 13-billion-year life and sort of put together the whole picture.
We talked earlier about the ability now with this new technology that Apogee has put together of being able to look back through time in ways that were just never technically possible before. I mean, because of the accuracy with which you can look now at parts of the center of the Milky Way where there's so much dust that only infrared light will penetrate, you have information that a few years ago was probably unimaginable. Are you getting to a point where you can say things more conclusively about theories like the Big Bang?
Well, the Big Bang is a little bit more distant from what the kinds of things we're working on. I mean, we're taking things that after the Big Bang went off, now how do galaxies assemble out of what the Big Bang started? Okay, so we're more, I don't want to say provincial, but we're trying to understand galaxy assembly. That's our main focus. And that happened, you know, hundreds of thousands of years after the Big Bang went off is when these things started to come together.
But Apogee will be, and already is, as Steve mentioned, based on some early science results, testing or putting constraints, if you will, on current theories and models of how the galaxy, our galaxy, came together. So there are various models out there that try to mimic the various galaxies that we see in our local neighborhood. And again, going back to the power of Apogee, is we're going to have unprecedented detail on this galaxy, the Milky Way. And so therefore, we're able to test some of these other models and say, hey, can those models come up with this Milky Way in your, you know, can you grow one of these Milky Ways in your models? And if not, then we're able to ask some very important questions and help those models grow.
And I would say one thing, just astronomers are very clever at using data in a wide variety of ways. And so even people who are not interested in galaxy formation are already using Apogee data to look for things like planets and things even on smaller scales than the Milky Way. And so, you know, people could very easily use, make extrapolations from Apogee data back to things on much larger scales than the Milky Way, as well as going down to smaller scales.
And actually, it's a tribute to the great precision that the instrument came together. It's actually performing in some ways much better than we anticipated. And this is attracting a whole group of new applications that people want to use the instrument for, because people just didn't realize we were going to build something that was so stable and so precise that you can actually see things that we hadn't advertised at the beginning of the project.
Gail Sosnowski, it's my understanding, just from scanning your homepage just before you got here today, that in addition to this project, there are other projects that you're working on. You're mentoring some other students who are working in the field of astronomy. And it looked to me in the quick glance that I had time for, like you're doing outreach work on astronomy. Are you looking for young people and getting them interested in astronomy? Is that tell us about that.
So there's two main things that I've been working on. We have at University of Virginia, we have an outreach group called Dark Skies Bright Kids, DSBK, which is a group that was founded a couple years ago by Kelsey Johnson, who's a faculty member. And it's targeted at bringing astronomy and science outreach activities and education to very, very rural elementary schools. So these are schools that have, it's very low industry. So they have fantastically dark skies. You can see stars. You can see the Milky Way. But because they're so rural and isolated, they tend to have very little science extracurricular education, after school activities. So this is a program where we go down and we'll do Fridays after school. We'll work with the kids for a couple hours every week for 6 or 8 weeks. And we do all kinds of hands-on, making comets and making craters and learning all about astronomy, and getting the kids used to the idea that science is fun. It's not just a boring classroom activity, if it is, but they can actually have fun with it and they can see role models. You know, it's graduate students and postdocs and faculty and community members, and they can see that science is done by people and that it's actually a fun activity.
So these are like 8, 9, 10, 11-year-old children that you're working with? And this is the age group that, as I understand the story, back when Steve Majewski was close to that age was when he first got out of Chicago on a scouting camping trip somewhere in Wisconsin, wasn't it?
Yes, in Wisconsin.
And saw the Milky Way in the sky for the first time, because growing up in the city, you couldn't see it.
I thought you got your PhD at age 10.
and back in Steve's day, when he was getting real excited about the stars, he was thinking about the possibility of becoming an astronaut. Most young people today probably don't see that as an option, but do you hear stories about, as they get interested in what's up there in the sky, about what that means to them, about what they might like to do in the future?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, actually, one of the things that we have the kids do is we have them, you know, describe or draw pictures of what they think a scientist is, both at the beginning and at the end of the club. And at the beginning, we get a lot of people, like you see in movies, people in lab coats, and they're usually designing chemicals that make things explode. But by the end, yes, they all have astronomers, and they know how to draw telescopes, and they have all stars in their pictures and everything. And it's really interesting to see how just the influence and the impact that we're able to have on the perceptions of science as we go.
John Wilson is the guy, again, who oversaw the creation of this new type of device that's making this research possible in a way that was never possible before. You described some earlier of some of the elements of the device, that the really tiny hundreds of fibers involved, the distance that they have to travel, the kind of rainbow creation device that has layers of gel, this huge crystal that we've talked only a little bit about. But it seems to me that often there's something about temperature that has to enter into this. And do I understand that at some point in this succession of elements, things have to be incredibly cold?
Yes, that's correct, Tom. The wavelengths that we're looking at happen to be wavelengths that are very close to what you and I are giving off as human beings. So we all give off some infrared radiation by virtue of our roughly 20, 30 degrees Celsius or 70 degree, our bodies. And the fact that we're trying to detect the very wavelengths, the very colors of light that that are being given off right around it, something has to give there. So that's a lot of what we would call noise. It's a bit like trying to look at stars during the daylight. The stars are there. We just can't see them because of the vast brightness of the sun.
So if you're looking at, again, looking, quote unquote, retrieving data through infrared light, and you've got heat interfering, what do you do about it?
We have to cool as much as we can. And so what we do, we can't do anything about the atmosphere, so we're going to get a little bit of radiation through the night sky just by the finite temperatures of the night sky, the layers of the Earth. We're going to get a little bit from the telescope mirrors, but everything else we try to cool down to temperatures that are less than negative 300 degrees C, so that those optics inside of our instrument and particularly that detector aren't flooded with this, again, what I would call noise.
Is there anything about dark matter that you're likely to discover through this research?
Yes. So getting back to what you're asking about, more cosmological questions. Obviously, one of the things that Apogee can do is look at the motions of stars. And by the way, we do that through the Doppler effect, which many people are familiar with through sound. You know, if something is coming at you, the pitch goes up. If it's going away, the pitch goes down. The same thing happens with starlight. So we're able to actually see how stars are moving by how their light is moving around back and forth. That information tells us about the mass in the Milky Way, because, of course, the stars are responding to gravity. And so we can actually use the information about how stars are moving to weigh the Milky Way. How much mass is there? And when people do these kinds of experiments, we see that there's more mass than we can actually account for by the stars. And that tells us that there's a mysterious substance called dark matter that is exerting a gravitational pull, but we don't know what it is. We can't see any radiation from this matter. By doing this large assessment of motions of stars in the galaxy, we're going to have a very nice way to map where at least the dark matter is distributed, if not what it is. We can at least figure out how it's clustered in the Milky Way, how it's distributed, and that will give us some constraints on the kinds of dark matter what kinds of dark matter we have.
So, with what's going on with this project that the three of you were instrumental in creating, in the 10 seconds that we have left, it seems to me that maybe it can be said that there is much, much more to come, more than you can predict.
Well, there's more to come with Apogee because we want to build another instrument for the southern hemisphere. So we're trying to build a second instrument in Chile to look at the other half of the sky that we can't see here in the United States.
You're collecting donations already.
Sure. Anyone wants to write a check, we're happy to take it.
Our guests have been Gail Sosowski, John Wilson, and Steve Majewski, all part of the astronomy department at the University of Virginia, and all part of the research project investigating thousands, well, actually tens of thousands of stars across our Milky Way galaxy. That project known as Apogee. Thank you all for making time for us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.